Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Isabel Hardman and James Forsyth. So we're quite far into the third week of Hell Month for Theresa May. And as far as we can tell, Theresa May is still in number 10 and she's not about to be ousted by the end of the week. Last night, Theresa May stood before her backbenchers at a meeting of the 1922 committee, with some reports saying that she was summoned and others saying that she decided to go of her own accord. James, you were sat in the committee corridor outside this when it happened. Can you tell us about the mood?
It was as you would expect, as we discussed yesterday. It was going to turn, always going to turn into a display of loyalty. You know, you could see that from the number of, I mean, I go to 1922, I stand outside 1922 committee every week. There were a huge number of people from the cabinet ministers down who normally never go, who were turning up to show their support for the prime minister. You know, you got the predictable desk banging and all that stuff. And most of the questions were supportive. I'm told there are about half a dozen questions which were all about tone, essentially, basically attacking the people who gave those hideous quotes to the Sunday newspapers. I also think that you can see the kind of loyalty off that was going on from the fact that Steve Baker, who's the kind of lead organiser for the ERG, he chose to frame his question not as a demand to the Prime Minister, but saying, aren't those Tory MPs who are saying that they would vote down no deal, aren't they undermining your negotiating position, Prime Minister? To which she agreed, and I think that was telling of the kind of mood of the room, that even the leader of the ERG was trying to say, you know, we are loyal to the Prime Minister in comparison to these other people over here who are saying they'll vote down no deal. And you could tell at the end that she looked relatively relaxed going in, but coming out was one of the more relaxed I've seen her since she became Prime Minister.
Now, Isabel, there were a few hostile questions, such as from Philip Davies. Can you tell us a bit about what the mood was in terms of that aspect of the room?
Well, it's interesting because I was talking to quite a few Tory MPs afterwards who want Theresa May to go or who are very unhappy with her leadership. And they'd been there and they said, look, you know, it was what it was. And it's very difficult, unless you're someone like Philip Davies, to be a critic in that forum. It hasn't changed anyone's mind about the Prime Minister one way or the other, but what it has done is allowed her to survive for a bit longer with a little bit more authority, basically. And actually, most of the MPs I've been speaking to have been saying that she would win a vote of no confidence if we did reach the 48-letter threshold. But it was interesting. I've been quite struck over the past couple of days by the number of, I'd say, moderate, not particularly angry MPs and ministers who I've spoken to who say they don't actually know how they would vote in that vote of no confidence, which suggests it would be much closer than number 10 thinks it would be.
It's fascinating that you say that as well, because yesterday I was speaking to someone on the payroll vote and they said, I would never send a letter in. But then they said that they would definitely vote no confidence in the ballot. And I think this explains a paradox. I was talking to one of the people who is actively trying to get rid of Theresa May yesterday, and they said they thought they were almost further away from 48 letters than they'd ever been, but they were actually closer if you could get to 48 letters than they'd been previously. I mean, this is the kind of weird paradox that is going on at the moment.
And I think one of the reasons for that is that there are two rows going, well, there's lots of rows going on, but the letters are being triggered largely by Brexit. But if you talk to people who would vote against the Prime Minister or who don't know how they'd vote in a vote of no confidence, which in itself is extraordinarily telling, because if you don't have confidence about your vote of confidence in the Prime Minister, it says a lot about their leadership. Those people often cite non-Brexit reasons for voting against her or for being unsure. Like, I was talking to one who said, I will never forgive her for the snap election. Now, they were absolutely fine, but they were just horrified by what Theresa May had done and what it said about her judgment. And so there was a much wider dynamic going on in the vote of no confidence. But there isn't a campaign going on, which I think is why number 10 is probably still right to think it would win, perhaps with a much smaller margin.
Now, James, in your column this week, you talk about Theresa May's troubles when it comes to Brexit and the fact that, yes, she's managed to get through this meeting, but ultimately the cabinet this week was very difficult for her, the Brexit one, when it came to talking about issues on the backstop, and there were a few rows.
Yes, and perhaps the most spectacular bit of it came towards the end of the meeting, when Claire Perry, who's kind of never knowingly understated, basically accused some people in the cabinet of using this discussion about the backstop and an escape clause to advance their own leadership ambitions. Those people in the room took this as a swipe at Jeremy Hunt, the Foreign Secretary. You know, Jeremy Hunt was a Remainer during the referendum. He initially considered running for Tory leader after the referendum result on a second referendum pledge, but he has now become much more in favour of a kind of cleaner Brexit, and he's very exercised about this backstop. Now, the kind of comedy element of all this is Claire Perry takes this swipe at Jeremy Hunt, but he misses this swipe because he's not in the room, because he's slipped out to put on his morning suit to get ready to meet the Dutch royal family. Now, there is one of these things that this cabinet meeting with this long discussion of Brexit, you know, overruns for 35 minutes. Theresa May's trying to wrap it up from 11:15. It doesn't end till 11:50 because everyone wants to have their say on Brexit. But I think there is something very British about that. In the middle of this discussion about Brexit, there actually started off being another discussion about whether you were meant to wear morning suits to go and meet the Dutch royal family or not. There's apparently a bit of a flap on when Jeremy Hunt says, oh, I need to go and put my morning suit on, and people are like, oh, do we need is morning suit the right dress for this? What should we be doing? I mean, it's a kind of it is one of those things that if someone put this into a political drama or comedy show, everyone would consider the scene to be overwritten, but such is the realities of government.
Now, Isabel, when it comes to the cabinet, it does feel as though you know, speaking to ministers, that actually the mood is growing against what's currently being proposed by Theresa May. What do you think is going to happen this? Can you see Theresa May, if it stays in its current form, getting it through?
No, and again, I was talking to a minister last night who was just saying that he's less bothered by the rows over Chequers, but he just doesn't think that there are the numbers at the moment for Theresa May to get anything like that through the Commons. And if you talk to backbenchers, there's a proposal going around, which is quite interesting, which is the possibility of an options bill, a bit like the one that Tony Blair had for House of Lords reform, where you could have a number of different options, including the deal that had been agreed for MPs to vote on. Now, the flaw that I can see with that is that Tony Blair did the options bill because he wasn't that bothered about House of Lords reform, whereas the Tories do really need to be bothered about Brexit because it is going to happen.
James, what do you think might break the deadlock, if anything?
I mean, this is a kind of fascinating question, which is these cabinet ministers are becoming more and more assertive. I also think that one of the routes out of this is being closed down, which is the Michael Gove's previous view used to be a kind of, look, let's just get out and fix it later. What Geoffrey Cox, the Attorney General, is doing is basically saying, actually, if we get out, you might not be able to fix it later. This treaty might be so locked down that it would be impossible to get out of it. So I think things are becoming more difficult. I think there is a fundamental moment at which, you know, is the EU prepared to move a little bit to help her out, to help her get a deal? Is that sufficient concern? Or are these cabinet ministers actually prepared to go down the path of no deal? I still doubt that that is the case, because I think that these cabinet ministers are also aware of a state of government preparations. I was walking into work today, and I noticed that there's a sign up at a Highbury corner, and it says, you know, works on this roundabout will continue until the end of 2019. And I'm like, if it takes us, and they started in 2018, if it takes us this long to deal with one roundabout, how are we going to deal with all the changes that you would need to make for no deal? And I think ministers who are aware of just how slowly the government machine operates are very worried about that. I think one other thing I think is well worth keeping an eye on is the Norway to Canada idea. I was very surprised this morning when someone called me up who I wouldn't have put down as a natural supporter of that, who basically said, you know, in the interest of a workable solution and party unity, this might be the only idea in town. And this person said that, you know, with the cabinet, this idea is now very much on the dance floor.
But would the Norway to Canada option actually solve the backstop?
This is the whole crux, right, which is Norway to Canada only works if the EU are prepared to kind of alter the backstop as part of it. I think they would be very reluctant to do so because there's not very much trust around at the moment. And the EU would say, well, you're talking about Norway to Canada, so why do we want to let you out of this snare that you're in? Because how do we then not end up having to have this argument with you in 2 years' time or 3 years' time, whenever you choose to leave the EEA and try and go to Canada? And I think the fundamental problem for Norway to Canada is the EU would only really be interested in it if it thought it would never move from Norway. You know, that the ship would never leave port, essentially. While as to sell it domestically, you're going to have to provide assurances and possibly guarantees that, you know, the ship would set sail and you would start heading to Canada either before the next election or within a relatively short time frame. That is the problem.
Now, over on domestic issues, the Home Office have found itself in trouble today with the Home Secretary
Sajid Javid apologising to people who were wrongly forced to take DNA tests to prove they're entitled to settle in the UK. Sajid Javid has said some relatives of Gurkhas and Afghan nationals employed by the UK government are among those affected. James, how much trouble do you think the Home Office will be in from this?
I think this is just yet another example of this Home Office culture. It seems to be almost the ultimate example of a bureaucracy that has forgotten its humanity. And it just behaves in these weird, bizarre ways. And again, you know, and also, lots of people say, "Ah, this is all because of what public opinion is." If there's a set of people who public opinion are, you know, inherently positive about coming to settle in the UK, the Gurkhas are the kind of classic example of this. The idea that we're forcing children of Gurkhas to take DNA tests to prove who they are, you know, that is not something that the public would want or would think was sensible. And I think this is the problem for any Home Secretary, which is that the bureaucratic mindset inside the Home Office. Now, some people would blame a recent long-serving Home Secretary for this mindset. But that mindset within the Home Office is so problematic because it just forgets, you know, what this looks like to anybody else.
It's the same as asylum seekers from countries that ban gay sex, for instance, having to have sex to prove that they're gay in order to stay in this country, which was a story that came up from the Home Office a few years ago. And the instance that I came across a case where someone returning to this country was being refused entry until they had a DNA test to prove that their child was theirs. But this person was in detention in Turkey on suspicion of terrorism and endangering national security. And the reason she needed a DNA test to prove her child was hers was because the Home Office weren't entirely sure that the child was hers and that she had either abducted this child or that she was bringing back someone else's child for them. And so you can understand those circumstances, but it's the idea that someone in detention on suspicion of terrorism is going to be treated the same way as the families of the Gurkhas. As you say, James, it's that bureaucratic mindset that makes the Home Office seem very inhuman, when actually the consequences of its decisions can wreck people's lives.
Thank you, Isabel. Thank you, James. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please do remember to subscribe and perhaps even leave us a review on the iTunes store. And if you really enjoy The Spectator, why not come to our Spectator budget briefing with Andrew Neil, Fraser Nelson and James on Wednesday the 31st of October. Get a free ticket to this event when you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/budget.